Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. It is by now a rather hoary cliché that necessity is the mother of invention. True as this may be, the more fascinating subject may be how innovation quickly takes over our inventions, developing new usages from basic forms in a way that involves the ceaseless interplay of technology, economics, and values. We humans are endlessly creative, and the brotherhood between those who invent and those who use and adapt is a principle and continuing feature of both our history and our destiny. My guest is Edward Tenner, author of Our Own Devices, The Past and Future of Body Technology, published by Knopf. Ed Tenner, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much.
I should say welcome back, because I had the pleasure of interviewing you years ago on an earlier fine book called Things Bite Back. Let me begin then with a question that I might have asked you at that time, too. You certainly do explore inventions that most of us take for granted. In fact, you've been called the philosopher of everyday things. And I guess a starting question would be, why this interest that you have with the kind of quotidian instrument and invention, and particularly why this interest in the unintended consequences of their use?
Everyday things are what shape our daily experience. Somebody who sits in a chair, works in a chair all day, comes home, dines sitting in a chair, watches television or reads in a chair, is really conditioned by that technology. They may be unaware that there are very high civilizations around the world where people have lived very well, some say more healthily, without a chair. So my question to people who think that these are strange objects to study is, what's more important than the way in which you spend your daily life?
Here's a key word in the layperson's mind, the lay reader such as myself of a book like this, that you give me a new respect for, the spinoff. How would you define the spinoff, Edward Tenner, and what is its importance to the subject we're talking about here?
I could say a spinoff is a positive unintended consequence. It is an indirect result of something that was started for another purpose. For example, in my chapter on eyeglasses, I mentioned the origins of modern cataract surgery,
right. Which
were in the Second World War, when a Dr. Ridley was operating on the eyes of RAF pilots who had been downed by the Germans, discovered that the bits of plexiglass, this new plastic material that were embedded in these flyers' eyes, did not inflame the eyes as other foreign matter did. And he started to get the idea that you could use this as a material for corneal transplants.
You know, this is why this book and your work and your conversation, to be precise, are endlessly fascinating.
Well, thank you.
It's absolutely true. Let me ask you this question. I mentioned at the outset a kind of interaction between the inventor and the consumer and the user, and the way things sort of evolve and change sometimes in very surprising ways. Do you consider the user a kind of co-inventor in that sense? I mean, those of us who adapt things because we, you know, just change the way we use them.
This is a big theme of the book, that the process of invention only starts when a product is out there. And I cite a case of an MIT economist who discovered that 71% of the innovations that he was studying were the result not of the research staff in the laboratories of the manufacturing companies, mm-hmm. but in initiatives taken by the customers, either things they developed themselves or requests that they made.
Right. Let me stay on this point in a slightly different way a moment longer. As I was reading the book, I happened to be watching, in the course of my reading of the book, one evening, a wonderful prison movie, you know, with a great escape sort of thing and all of that. And it crossed my mind, again with the book in my mind, that perhaps there's also kind of a deviant ingenuity that you can bring to things, other than, you know, turning the consequences of the thing on its head for deviant purposes.
All technology is dual-use technology. That mm-hmm. is one feature of it. It also means that sometimes there are good uses for bad things, so it isn't all unfortunate. But there is no limit to what people can find in their quest for innovation. I give the example, not in this book, but in another piece that I wrote, of a bit of ceramic from a spark plug that's called a ninja rock, and that's used by thieves to shatter the glass of windows of automobiles, the side windows, to break into them. There was a very interesting case that I heard about in a southern state where a man was apprehended with one of these fragments tied to a string because he was thrifty. You know, he didn't want to let it go. But that was his undoing, because if he had just been caught with this would just have been a bit of junk in his pocket. But because it had a string on it, the court ruled that this was a burglar's tool, and he got a prison sentence. So you're talking about prison. It can be a two-way street. On the other hand, prisoners have been famous for their ability to distill liquor from mm-hmm. almost anything, and to otherwise improvise.
Absolutely. I guess this is just one of the prices that we have to pay for having the invention in the first place. Let's go through some of the subjects of this very fascinating book, starting with what we start with as human beings, kind of our first introduction to technology in a way, bottle feeding, I guess, for many listening. This is our first touch with technology. Now, as I understand it, Edward Tenner, this really owes to the whole notion of there being bottles and formulas for infants to take is a kind of an early 20th century development that got very popular through much of the century, but then got debunked largely, I think, as medical research began to indicate maybe it wasn't so great after all. But here's the question. It's persisted, has it not, as a very popular activity in society? I guess the question is why.
Well, it really corresponds to the needs of a lot of families. And in the book, I am not trying to denounce bottle feeding or to make any extreme claims against it. What interests me much more is the naivete of some of the greatest scientists of the 19th century who thought they understood everything about children's nutrition, mm-hmm. and they had a formula. That's why we use the word formula. They had a formula that was just as good as mother's milk, maybe better. And this was before the rise of really the mass use of bottles that you were referring to. This was more of a minority thing in Europe and the United States, and especially parents who could afford it. In fact, late in the 19th century, there was even a movement that a pediatrician had to prescribe a formula custom for each infant. So you take the infant to the doctor, and the doctor would prescribe the formula. And then there were specialized milk companies like Walker Gordon in Plainsboro, where I live, that would make the milk
specifically to the
formula. Or they would make milk that would be mixed then to make the formula. And at the time, they didn't understand anything about the immune system, about the hormones that come with mother's milk, about the studies that we've done in the 20th century about how breastfeeding over the long term gives kids a mild benefit. But again, it's not a matter of people being unfair to their children if they're bottle feeding. It's just that if breastfeeding is possible, we now know that it is better, and the longer it's done, the better for the child. And that was the point of that chapter. But it was interesting that there was an element of invention connected with the rise of the bottle in the 20th century, because only around 1900 did glass manufacturers know how to mass produce a complete bottle. Before that, every bottle had to have the lip hand formed.
That's right.
And it was only in 1903 that they developed the glass blowing machinery that is still used 100 years later that can just take the raw ingredients and come out with a finished bottle. And then, of course, you had Pyrex, mm-hmm. and you had the possibility of sterilizing bottles.
Absolutely.
And you also had nipples that were all more hygienic, too.
Yeah.
In the 19th century, many of these bottles were very unsanitary.
You know, one thing that occurs to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, though, that one of the other reasons that bottle feeding, when, as you point out, it became possible to make these bottles and mass produce them and so forth, the bottle feeding retained popularity even after we discovered it was marginally less healthful than the breastfeeding, is it gives the father a role. Or,
yeah.
or those who are other than the mother a role in raising the infant.
Yes, that's a very important point. Yeah. I mentioned that
yeah.
in the book.
Yeah, you do indeed. Footwear. There's a lot in this book on footwear, and every part of it fascinates me. Let me take in quick succession three things I found particularly riveting. Sandals. I gained a new respect for sandals from reading this book. Now, there's a type of sandal known as a zori in Japan. Is this correct, Edward?
Mm-hmm.
And here's what I thought was a real paradox, and one which may have tended toward the negative rather than the positive, became immensely popular in Japan because the foot is allowed to breathe using a sandal. You could use natural, perishable materials in making it. It was a marvelously kind of healthy way to go about the world. And then it got, of course, popular on our side of the world. But then, and I guess this is the question, did something happen in the mass production of the zori, or the thong, or whatever we call them now, these sandals, which is actually a biological hazard, that is to say, the kinds of materials we began to make them from.
Yes, especially the use of plastic mm-hmm. for zori has made the sandal a very frequent item of debris on mm-hmm. beaches and other public areas all over the world, and sometimes whole container loads of zori will be dumped at sea, and then they will wash up on beaches. Mm-hmm. So it's, as you said, it started out as a environmentally benign mm-hmm. form of technology and is widely regarded as a menace. In its defense, though, I should say that in many poor countries, it is a very affordable form of footwear for people who otherwise wouldn't have had
right.
any, and so it can prevent the transmission of diseases, too.
Mm-hmm. I remember as a Peace Corps volunteer in Brazil, flip-flops also, was another sandalias, as they were known in Brazil, of course, every ubiquitous, seen everywhere, mm-hmm. and as you were after the preferred foot covering of those who didn't have much in the way of resources. Shoelaces. I'd never given much attention to shoelaces before reading this, but is it correct to think that they too have a much more significant history and the way that they came into human usage and the way we've developed them than we might otherwise think?
I was surprised by how much history shoelaces have. For one thing, that Thomas Jefferson himself recommended them in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. The aristocracy wore shoes with silver buckles, and you still have that in the children's rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
But at the turn of the century, with the French and American revolutions, there were new ideas of equality, and the laces, which already had been known in shoes before then, now became an item of fashionable footwear too, following Jefferson's example. Mm-hmm. So they soon took a position that all these high-tech materials still have not replaced. If you go into a store today and you ask for one of the newest kinds of sneakers or a pair of dress shoes, the chances are 95-5 or more mm-hmm. that they will have laces rather than Velcro or any other exotic material.
Absolutely. Do I take it then, Edward, that there was something of a political statement being made by shoelaces, by Jefferson, as he
yes,
brought them
yes,
to being?
Yes, that these were more this was a more democratic way of fastening shoes because you didn't need precious metal.
Right. We're actually going to look at athletic shoes in just a moment because I think that's another fascinating part of this book. But let me take a moment from our conversation to say that this is Dialogue, a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. My guest today is Edward Tenner, author of Our Own Devices, The Past and Future of Body Technology, published by Knopf. Athletic shoes. These are truly ubiquitous. You can't go 10 feet anywhere in this country without seeing many pairs of them. Lots to be said about them, and a lot is said in this book. They seem to have gotten much more complex over time. They I think, originally came about by the innovation of individual athletes, I guess, and sort of adapting shoes to their purpose. But now, as we both know, television has enhanced their appeal. They're a major commercial item. And I guess the question here, Edward, among many others, is haven't they created, in their social and economic impact, particularly their social impact, some problematic issues for this society and I guess for others abroad of different kinds?
There are lots of social issues involving sneakers. In fact, as many as I can think of for any item of footwear. One is that sneakers were one of the first mass-produced items of clothing to be outsourced extensively.
That's right.
Uh-huh. And it's partly because of their style of construction. The leather shoe still requires a lot more artisanal training than the sneaker. A sneaker can basically be sewn by factory workers who have no previous shoe experience. And the invention, I shouldn't say the invention because they had existed for some time, but the development of the modern sneaker created a crisis in the shoe industry because there were many people with years and years of experience in designing shoes and designing the production processes before shoes who suddenly were faced with the loss of their livelihoods because of the competition from sneakers, whether made in the United States or overseas. And that process paradoxically meant that the few people who are still around who know those skills and are consultants to the international footwear industry can get a very high hourly rate for their consulting.
The sneaker diminished the number of cobblers?
Yes, the sneaker diminished not only the number of cobblers, but also the number of skilled shoe designers who were working with three-dimensional models. Mm-hmm. So there was a new way of sewing shoes, a new way of constructing shoes, or rather of not of constructing shoes, of bonding an upper to a rubber or synthetic base. And that led to a tremendous upheaval. But there was also a new system of manufacture that was very, very significant. And that is that the sneaker, especially the high-performance sneaker, has two parts. One is a kind of generic part, and it consists of the upper and most of the sole. But there's typically a material between the upper and the sole, and that is often what is patented.
Right.
That is really what makes the shoe so distinctive and often so expensive.
Right.
And those shoes are often made largely overseas, but very often companies, American companies, will make the inset in factories in the United States because that's the key to the kingdom.
Right.
They do not want other people reverse engineering it.
That's so, like the formula of Coca-Cola.
That's right. So in other words, this is a form of product that has an element of intellectual property built into it.
Right.
And many more things become like that, that you can have a generic production anywhere in the world, but there is a core that you don't want to divulge.
That distinguishes your product
from
everyone else's.
That's right.
That's fascinating. Absolutely. Of course, domestically, in a very, very different, from a very, very different kind of perspective, there have also been some social issues created by the success of these shoes because there have been patterns of delinquency and deviancy built around just having to have them. You know, when your resources may not permit you to get them.
Yeah, it can be tragic. As you know, people have been killed for their shoes, and I think it has a lot to do with the very skill of these shoe designers in creating a strong emotional response for the shoes. It was interesting that one of the key designers, Tinker Hatfield of Nike, was not originally trained as a shoe designer at all. He was an architect, and he had designed interior spaces for Nike shops, but he had a great sense of drama, has a great sense of drama, and he brought this form of theater to footwear. And as I describe in the book, this actually started with a historic football match between Hungary and the Federal Republic of Germany, in which the television cameras were there for the first time, and which they picked up this distinctive Adidas logo.
Right.
And that is when the shoe manufacturers realized that television was going to give their products a new brand identity if they could come up with a way to make this visible in the design of the shoe. The design of the Adidas shoe was originally a functional one, a kind of decorated functional one. They had no idea that television cameras were going to be there and we have to make this standard. Mm-hmm. It was one of those very interesting, happy accidents for them.
Well, I would say that it's one could almost think of it as a kind of a marriage between television and the athletic shoe that really has lived happily ever after for both those parties.
Yes.
There is so much in this book, Edward Tenner, and anyone listening to us, I think, is going to want to read his or her own copy of it. I don't want to leave our conversation, though, without focusing, at least for a moment, on chairs. We mentioned them at the outset, but I think they, like everything else here, deserve a lot more attention. And one of the fascinating things is, correct me if I'm wrong, but we really don't need them. I mean, if we were in a different culture and we're willing to get along as people in other cultures to this day do, despite, you know, squatting, which might be healthier for our legs, actually. But the chair came into being perhaps for reasons of social hierarchy as much as convenience and comfort. Is that right?
I think that's fair to say. The first chairs were used in ancient Egypt, and because there was so little wood there, the wood had to be imported. So the chair was established from the outset as something reserved for royalty or the very highest part of the nobility, and as such it spread around the Mediterranean, and Mediterranean peoples ever since were distinctive in this form of seating. But then, as I describe in the book, their taste spread around the world as European diplomats and soldiers occupied a lot of the world, and more of the world adopted them. But I have seen designs for computer terminals that can be run by people who are seated at mat level. You could have all of modern society in just about every application at mat level. So it's not something determined by industrial society or post-industrial society. It is a cultural trend that's still not completely understood. For example, nobody really knows why 1,000 years ago the Chinese started sitting on chairs while the Japanese, for hundreds of years more, continued to live at mat level. There is speculation, and I discuss it in the book, but nobody can really explain why such a momentous change in everyday habits occurred.
Absolutely. You mentioned computers, and I thought one of the most riveting chapters in this book focuses on the keyboard. And, of course, keyboards have been part of human history for hundreds of years, musical keyboards first, and then textual keyboards later, which are now everywhere and myriad applications, from calculators on up. That's literally revolutionized the way we all live, hasn't it?
It has. And one thing that I discovered in writing it was that a lot of the purpose of the typewriter was not really writing faster, because a skilled clerk could write at the outset almost as fast as a typical typist. Mm-hmm. The real reason was the uniformity in appearance of the writing that it gave. And the typewriter was developed at the time when both companies and governments were getting bigger and bigger, and there were also more publications than ever before. So if you had to read one document after another, in one handwriting after another, work would become very, very difficult. And it's this uniformity, rather than speed at first, that accounted for the rise of the typewriter. But then, getting back to what you were saying about the user and the inventor, it was users of the typewriter who went from a typesetting model where you were using two fingers and a thumb of each hand to the touch typing model that was designed for speed. They and not the original inventors and manufacturers thought of it.
It's fascinating, absolutely. And of course, and when I read that chapter, I thought of all the keyboards that I deal with in my own daily life and routine, which is like everyone else's, I'm sure. My calculator, the telephone, the computer, et cetera. They're just, you know, just ubiquitous, I guess is the word.
And I'd also discuss how miniaturization has made different kinds of keyboards even more ubiquitous, so that in Japan, for example, people are now talking about a so-called thumb generation. These are kids who have grown up using these handheld devices. And so the thumb now becomes the most important digit, no longer the index finger. So they will point directions, go that way. They will point with their thumb. They'll ring doorbells with their thumb. And it struck me as a wonderful case of the adaptability of both the human body and of technology.
That's absolutely great, Ed. Well, to conclude this conversation, as I said earlier, as fascinating for me as the book is, I think for everyone who gets a chance to read it, the obvious question occurs to me, and it is, what do you see on the horizon right now? What trends of this kind? Because your mind, I think, never ceases to set itself on these kinds of things. What fascinates you at the moment?
One of the things I talk about in the book is that people a few years ago were really interested in the cyborg idea and in the hybrid of the person and the machine. But I detect an even greater interest in the refashioning of the organism itself. In other words, instead of having an external machine that would help you overcome some disability, you could regenerate the natural function. And so there is always a movement between developing new external devices and finding other technologies that will somehow modify the body itself so that you won't need the external devices. And I see that as one of the big themes of the coming years.
And I would like to see that as one of the big themes of Ed Tenner's next book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
It was my pleasure. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Edward Tenner, author of Our Own Devices, The Past and Future of Body Technology, published by Knopf. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.